It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. Dan Kaufman's book, The Fall of Wisconsin, details a lot of our state's history, but it ultimately examines who we are now. How did Wisconsin come to be one of the few states that put President Trump over in the Electoral College? How did Scott Walker come to power? And what has happened to the Wisconsin idea? Has Wisconsin fallen? Do you want it to return to its progressive roots? Or do you think that we're moving in the right direction? If so, why? Give us a call, 800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@WPR.org or tweet at WPR Mornings. Dan Kaufman is no relation to me, but we share the same last name. He's a Wisconsin native and author of the book, The Fall of Wisconsin, The Conservative Conquest of a Progressive Bastion and the Future of American Politics. Dan, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Carrie.
So you grew up here in Madison. You moved to New York some time ago. What kept you interested in writing about Wisconsin?
Well, I think, you know, the catalyst was the Act 10 bill, the stripping of collective bargaining rights for public employees. I became fascinated with the protest movement that had risen up against it and the battle. Labor had not been an issue on people's radar for quite some time across the country. And here was kind of the first mass labor protest, I think, in decades, mm-hmm. really. So that was what drew me in. And then Wisconsin politics had shifted quite remarkably, and I kept following it through the recall election, the right to work bill in 2015, and found some interesting, really fascinating protagonists that are sort of the heart and soul of my book. These are people like Randy Bryce, the iron worker who is challenging Speaker of the House Paul Ryan's congressional seat, Lori Compass, a wedding photographer who, through her own determination, led a recall effort against Scott Fitzgerald, the Senate Majority Leader, and ultimately ran against him in his district. Chris Taylor, the Democratic Assemblywoman, is another person I follow who she has joined the American Legislative Exchange Council as a way to kind of learn what was coming next for Wisconsin. This is a group that generates a lot of model policies for states across the country.
This is ALEC. This is the famous ALEC that we hear about.
Right. So these people are the heart and soul of the book. One other battle that I followed very closely was the fight over a mine near the Bad River Reservation in northern Wisconsin. This was the bill that kind of transformed Wisconsin environmental law was drafted by the company that was trying to put the mine in. So these were all things that were really captivating, and particularly the people involved, their determination to restore the state to its previous kind of ideals was interesting to me. And I, of course, knew the state fairly well from growing up here.
So let's talk about the history of the state a little bit. Wisconsinites have pioneered some pretty impactful legislation. Talk to us about...
They have, yes. This was something that I knew distantly growing up, but I really learned much more thoroughly in researching this book. The state was founded, many groups founded it, but one of the two most important immigrant groups were Scandinavians and Germans. And some of these immigrants brought with them different ideas that impacted the state's progressive character. The Scandinavians were fleeing a harsh environment. In Norway, for example, only 3% of the land is arable. It's very difficult to survive by farming. Mm-hmm. And about a quarter of Norway's population immigrated to the United States. Their top destinations were Wisconsin, Minnesota, and North Dakota. And a lot of these Scandinavians brought with them a kind of communitarian ethos. This was captured in Thorsten Veblen's work, and this idea that social modesty, and we're in this together, not everyone, but this led to the forming of agricultural cooperatives, and Finnish immigrants organized these mines in northern Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. The other group that was really important was the German immigrants, who were many of them fleeing a failed revolution in 1848, and they settled in Milwaukee, and some of them brought with them some radical politics, liberal, sometimes radical politics. And they had a movement called the Turners, which was a gymnastics movement, but also a social gathering space, and these political ideas were fomented there. And out of this, a kind of reformist socialist tradition formed in Milwaukee, and they had several socialist mayors. This led to an interesting mix, and these people coalesced around the new Republican Party, which was founded in a one-room schoolhouse in Ripon, Wisconsin, and on abolitionist principles, really fervently abolitionist principles, and they supported Abraham Lincoln fervently. And out of this came an ethos, sort of, and one of the catalysts for it was the university's chancellor, John Bascom, who came to the UW in the 1860s and into the 1870s and made a huge impact on kind of the pivotal figure of Wisconsin progressivism, Bob La Follette, mm-hmm. Fighting Bob. Bascom believed that society was kind of like an organism, and if it became too imbalanced, the whole of it suffered. So he favored a kind of activist government to mitigate extreme income inequality. He believed that women should be entitled to education. That was a big issue at the time. He felt like that would free them from subjugation by men, and other reforms to make society more fair and equitable. This had a huge impact on Bob La Follette, and he became senator and governor, and he forged a close alliance with the university that became known as the Wisconsin Idea. He wanted to draw on the expertise of the university to craft legislation that would benefit the citizens as a whole. Some of his laws were, when he was governor, were involved direct election of, getting rid of these conventions where candidates were chosen and having primary elections because the process had been corrupted by these parties. And it led to many other laws that were very sweeping and important to the country as a whole. For example, the workers' compensation law, which was drafted by a professor at the UW named John Commons. And this was in 1911. And before that, it was the first workers' compensation law in the country. Before that, if a worker was killed on the job, his family would be destitute. There was no recourse. And this was a problem for the whole of society. The state would be, you know, these people would be destitute. They would be often living with relatives. And it was a tragic situation. And his law became a model for states across the country. There were other reforms, for example, the first unemployment insurance program. And in fact, much of the New Deal was drafted by Wisconsinites loyal to the Wisconsin Idea. For example, the Social Security Act and the Medicare program were drafted by Wisconsinites under the sway of this progressive movement.
So that is the Wisconsin Idea. This all turned around, the Wisconsin Idea, in 2010. With the Walker administration and Act 10, but also we paint this ideal picture of Wisconsin, but we do have people in our history in the 1940s and 50s, for instance, like Joe McCarthy,
sure,
who did not embody the Wisconsin ideal.
Absolutely, and I think it got eroded before Governor Walker took office. Joe McCarthy, as you mentioned, was elected twice. There were other examples of right-wing populism asserting itself in Wisconsin. For example, in 1964, the segregationist governor, George Wallace, really launched his national political career in Wisconsin. He won 25% of the statewide vote and 31% in Milwaukee. I don't think any state is clearly one way or the other. I would say, though, that the dominant tradition was this progressive one. And I would also say that it was a bipartisan tradition for many decades. For example, in the late 60s, a Republican governor, Warren Knowles, was the one that enshrined collective bargaining rights for all state employees. This was passed by a Republican legislature. The tradition of environmental stewardship, that was Tommy Thompson actually preserved a lot of the state's natural lands.
Tommy Thompson was our governor.
Was governor in the 1990s. And so there was, it wasn't always clearly one political party or another. However, I think there were certain norms that were widely accepted. Another one would be the idea of government transparency and the encouraging people to vote. Wisconsin, for a long time, had some of the easiest voter registration laws in the country. These things were accepted by the population as a whole, and I think that has radically changed.
We are talking about Dan Kaufman's book, The Fall of Wisconsin. And by fall, I don't think he means autumn. I think he means fall. We are going to come back and talk about what happened in 2010 and maybe just a little bit before that set us up for 2010. It's a morning show on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. Wisconsin has taken a hard right turn in the last decade. Dan Kaufman says that started with the Supreme Court's Citizens United decision to essentially allow the free flow of unchecked money in elections. Did you know that Scott Walker spent $30 million in his recall election, but his closest opponent only spent about 10% of that? Has money changed our state? Are you okay with that? Does the ends justify the means? Or is the corporate relationship something that is hurting our state? And now we're talking about the book, The Fall of Wisconsin. What do you think of the name of that book? Has Wisconsin fallen? Has Wisconsin stumbled? Is Wisconsin standing up straight and tall? Give us a call, 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Excuse me. In 2010, the Supreme Court decision issued its Citizens United decision, which led corporations, labor unions, and other groups to spend unlimited amounts of money on politics. Talk to us about how that formed what we're dealing with now.
Well, Citizens United involved federal elections, but it did embolden the right, particularly these outside groups that were funded by powerful donors like Charles and David Koch. Americans for Prosperity was a very important player in Wisconsin's politics. That's their political arm. And they were active in supporting Governor Walker, even when he was, Governor Walker was involved with several important rallies as Milwaukee County executive hosted by AFP. And he was also a member of an organization that was very important in Wisconsin's transformation, the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC. Right, which first came to real notice in 2011. A University of Wisconsin professor, a renowned professor named William Cronin, Bill Cronin, wrote a blog post that mentioned ALEC and said that they may have been involved in the drafting of some of these new laws, including Act 10 and the new voter ID bill.
So I just want to look at ALEC for a minute, because what I know of ALEC is that they are a national organization,
right,
and they have specific state legislation that they want to get passed. And often they will draft legislation and just hand it to legislators.
Well, yes.
And the legislation then looks the exact same in Mississippi, in Wisconsin, in Seattle, in Washington, as it does anywhere else.
Well, one of the protagonists in my book is a woman named Chris Taylor, who is a progressive Democrat, but who joined ALEC as a way to learn what was coming next for Wisconsin. So I went to a couple of ALEC conferences, and it's a quasi-legislative process which involves conservative think tanks, places like the Goldwater Institute, corporations, ExxonMobil, others, and state legislators. It's a three-pronged stool, if you will. And in Taylor's view, the legislators are the junior partner. They're essentially given legislation and they distribute it. Now, they probably ideologically agree with this. A lot of this can be attritional. It's small bills to chip away at public education. Mm. But over 40 years, this organization was founded in the early 1970s, along with the Heritage Foundation and the Cato Institute, other key players in this conservative infrastructure that has really waged a war, I would say, on some of the legacy of the New Deal and just the idea of the government doing, having any kind of active role in society beyond national defense and certain infrastructure things. They really have libertarian ideology. Their motto is, you know, free markets, federalism, limited government. And that translates into drafting bills that, for example, ban local communities from having a fee on plastic bags. But they're funded. They're really a corporate-driven organization. As I mentioned, ExxonMobil, the pharmaceutical lobby, all of these groups are part of it. And it's a very useful tool to get their policy prerogatives into the state houses. It's also been an interesting strategy for the right. It's a state-based strategy to transform the country. And you can see that, how effective it was in Wisconsin with Act 10 and other things. Sometimes successful efforts are then taken to ALEC and then distributed that way. For example, the Trayvon Martin Stand Your Ground bill mm-hmm. was drafted by an NRA lobbyist in Florida, and then it was taken to an ALEC meeting. In propagated to states across the country. 26 states passed a version of it, including Wisconsin. So ALEC is an amplifier and a disseminator of a lot of these ideas that are the priority of the conservative right.
So how did Citizens United then kind of hook up with what ALEC was already doing?
Well, it amplifies the right's ability. The conservative movement will always have more money. I mean, there's an equal right to spend, but it's the labor movement has been completely tapped out and has been decimated. I mean, they could never compete. The revenue of the Fortune 500 alone is several hundred times the entire union movement. So while there's an equal right to spend, there's no money on the other side. It emboldened the conservative right. A lot of dark money started flooding into Wisconsin, particularly during the recall election. You can see in these emails that were leaked to The Guardian during the John Doe investigation, mm-hmm. Scott Walker's fundraisers were saying, you know, go after Sheldon Adelson and so on and so forth. It allowed a lot of independent groups like Wisconsin Club for Growth to act, I would argue, and many people would argue, as supporters, de facto supporters of a candidate, but not be restricted by limitations on campaign spending.
We are talking about Dan Kaufman's book, The Fall of Wisconsin, and we're taking your calls, 800-642-1234. We've got Jerry from Waukesha. Welcome to the program, Jerry.
Yeah, good morning. This gentleman is an author coming out of New York. Does he live in Wisconsin, or does he still live in New York?
He grew up in Wisconsin.
Oh, okay. So, obviously, then he's aware of what happened in New York. They decimated the industrial and manufacturing world there. They're offering 5 years of free tax credit to come and move your business to New York. Wisconsin, I think, isn't on a fall. It's not in the toilet bowl. I don't agree with everything Scott Walker did, but I agree with Act 10 because no school teachers need Viagra.
Teachers need Viagra? What does that mean?
Yeah, that's part of the bargaining, the collective bargaining that was gotten rid of by Act 10. That's what they had in their bargaining process, free Viagra for the school teachers. And all kinds of other ridiculous benefits that went away when Act 10 came in. So
that was part of their health care bill, that was one of the...
Apparently, right. So there's a lot of things, you know, I'm suspect of the Foxconn thing, but if they don't produce 13,000 jobs, they'll never get the money that's promised. So they have to produce the jobs or they won't get the $4.5 billion. we got to fix our roads. You know, Governor Doyle raided the transportation fund. We built a $600 million building on the southwest corner of Madison to house the DOT workers because their office space must have been full of asbestos. There's a whole lot of different things that you know, need to be fixed properly. But is Wisconsin falling? No, I don't think it's falling. I think everyone's upset because it's controlled by the Republicans at this time.
Thank you very much, Jerry. So I do want to go. You do live in New York.
Sure.
My impression is New York is doing pretty well these days.
Well, in a lot of ways it is. I mean, there's problems in every state. I would ask the caller, and he mentioned Foxconn. I wonder if one could argue it's a successful model to give $4.5 billion to a foreign corporation that's allowed to take 7 million gallons of water from Lake Michigan a day. Is that a successful economy? I would question that. I think New York has problems, but there is a lot of economic growth. No state is perfect. I do think, though, that Wisconsin has retreated from some core principles that have damaged its economy. The idea of public investment. You can pick on little things like Viagra or whatever, but I think it's fairly absurd to strip collective bargaining rights based on something a trope like that.
So. I actually overheard somebody talking once here, not that long ago, not in this building, but near, saying that his wife was a teacher. I don't know if his wife was an elementary school teacher or a university school, but he thought that her benefits were too much, and I was pretty amazed. I was just overhearing the conversation.
If I could just talk about that a little bit, I think one of the things that happened is Scott Walker was elected at a time of deep economic insecurity. It was during the financial crisis. A lot, and rural Wisconsin has really struggled for a long time. A lot of times, the only people in a local community that have health insurance are people that work for the state or the city. So there was, and he deliberately stoked resentment against them. He said in his inaugural address, the public employees can no longer be the haves and the taxpayers the have-nots. Well, first of all, public employees are taxpayers. Mm-hmm. Second of all, there was no idea or effort to lift everyone up, which may have been the version of the Wisconsin of old, where you would try to get health insurance for everyone, not take something away. It's true their benefits were good, but their wages were much less than the private sector. So there was a trade-off in that they definitely had less wages than they would make in the private sector. So I think it was a balance, and it was negotiated between both sides,
And Act 10 was not. Act 10 was
Act 10 was never announced. Scott Walker never campaigned on anything like that. In fact, he told the Oshkosh Northwestern prior to the election that he would use collective bargaining to negotiate changes in their healthcare contributions and pension benefits. So it came out of nowhere, but it had been around. There was a memo from a person at the MacGyver Institute who suggested that the way to fix the budget was to strip workers of collective bargaining rights and other things. I don't know if Walker took that memo to heart or what, but the idea was around in this conservative infrastructure.
Talk to me. Somebody mentioned the MacGyver Institute the last hour. Talk to me about what that is.
Well, it's one of these constellation of conservative think tanks. It's been funded by groups like the Bradley Foundation, which is based in Milwaukee. And it disseminates ideas. I believe it's a member of Alec. I can't remember off the top of my head. Most of them are. It's part of a constellation of conservative think tanks called the State Policy Network. And they act in conjunction with ALEC. They're members of ALEC, and they disseminate these model bills and ideas that are then taken up by the states. And, they're very important in this effort to transform the states.
So Act 10 is often talked about as something that really hurt the state. There are other people who say, like our caller did, that it's perfectly fine.
Sure.
You talked to Randy Bryce, who is currently running for Paul Ryan's seat. He's one of the people that thinks it hurt the state, but some union workers thought it was really great.
Some union workers, like other citizens, saw themselves as different. This is what Bryce talked to me about. People in his local, for example, they saw themselves as a different category. In fact, Walker kind of encouraged that. He said he would not pass a right-to-work bill in public. He said that. Privately, however, he alluded to doing just that. There's a famous video clip that probably many of the listeners are aware of, where he's speaking to a billionaire donor named Diane Hendricks, and she asks him, when will we ever become a completely red state, a right to work? And he says, well, look at what we're going to do in a couple of weeks with the public employees, because you use divide and conquer. And in a sense, that was a successful strategy. Again, he stoked resentment that was probably there. There's a lot of anger at the teachers, you know, the summer's off and so on and so forth. I would argue that that anger is also rooted somewhat in people's own economic conditions. Mm-hmm. It's a very, a lot of people are struggling to get by. And I think that resentment caught fire because of the particular moment we were living in. And there wasn't an effective counter message. You have to understand that also the Democratic Party was, in a sense, responsible. One of the people I speak to, a man named Dave Poklinkowski, who's the head of the local electricians union in Madison, he said, you know, I call Walker son of Doyle. This is referring to Jim Doyle. Mm-hmm. Jim Doyle promised when he was first elected that he would cut 10,000 state workers. And in 2010, he boasted to a reporter that he had cut more public employees than any governor in history. So there was a rhetorical attack, I would argue, on the public sphere.
And Jim Doyle was a Democrat.
He was a Democrat. So there was not a whole lot of defense of public employees and what they do. Like, for a long time, Wisconsin, you know, we had an exemplary civil service, and these kinds of things were venerated jobs for a lot of people. They were, the DNR had some of the finest scientists in the state working for it. It was an honored profession that was appreciated by the citizenry as a whole. That started to change before Scott Walker.
We are talking about Dan Kaufman's book, The Fall of Wisconsin, and we are taking your calls, 800-642-1234. Andy from Libertyville, welcome to the program.
Hi, and thank you for taking the time to talk us through all this. I just wanted to add a comment and I'm in agreement that this has been a step-by-step deconstruction of kind of the Wisconsin's rights, which is now spilling over into, like, the neighboring states. I know the Koch brothers were instrumental in trying to push the legislation to eliminate the right to work and, you know, collective bargaining. And that has now made way for companies like Foxconn that are coming in and, in my opinion, are exploiting citizens of Wisconsin. And it's resulting in all sorts of environmental negative effects on, you know, members of Illinois, such as the filling in of the 26 acres of wetlands that will now most assuredly flood people in Illinois. So I just, you know, wanted to thank your guest because it totally makes sense. But I'm just wondering, what will it take to get the people of Wisconsin to see that there's this manipulative force that's trying to take away, you know, from Wisconsin?
What will it take to get the people of Wisconsin to see?
I'm not sure. I'm a journalist, so I can't.
You're
I
not
can't
a prognosticator.
I'm not a prognosticator. I do think that there's certain revivals. The Act 10 protest movement, I think, was a galvanizing thing for a lot of people. The Bernie Sanders campaign in Wisconsin also galvanized a lot of people, surprisingly in rural conservative areas. I remember speaking to a wonderful moderate Republican state senator named Dale Schultz, who's a big protagonist in my book. And he told me that he had never seen anything like the Sanders campaign in his district in Richland County, where he lives. That's west of Madison. He said people were really on fire. And then when Sanders dropped out and it became a contest between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, that this anger that people were feeling from their declining living standards, which he described vividly, got behind Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. It was an anti-establishment feeling. And I think people forget, too, that Donald Trump always larded his speeches, particularly in Wisconsin and the industrial Midwest, with a defense of Social Security and Medicare, as well as really railing against these free trade agreements that have really hollowed out a lot of the industrial base that the state relied on. There's a study done that Wisconsin has lost more than 70,000 manufacturing jobs from NAFTA and China's admittance to the World Trade Organization. That's a lot of good paying jobs for people without a college degree. Mm-hmm. And it trickles down. When you take away union wages, studies have shown that wages for everyone decline because, you know, these people are going out to restaurants, they're buying things for their kids and so on. And when they have less money, the community as a whole suffers. So
there's anger, and that anger found itself as settled on Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump. And against Hillary Clinton.
Well, I think they're different strands, of course, but I think Sanders was someone that was able to galvanize the state's progressives who felt, I think, I mean, I can't speak for them, but in my reporting, there was a sense of beleagueredness and a sense of abandonment by particularly some of the activist base of this movement that the National Democrats had forgotten them. And most of your listeners probably know that Barack Obama never came to Wisconsin to defend collective bargaining rights. In fact, avoided making an appearance with Tom Barrett during the election. I mean, he just wouldn't come, although Barrett asked him to. That, you know, I think there was a sense of disaffectedness from a lot of the state's progressive. There was little enthusiasm for Hillary Clinton. There were many other reasons she lost that were not related to her. There's a study out about Wisconsin's voter ID law that suggests that 11% of the state's voters were deterred from voting, not at the polls, but just the law made it too complicated, or not complicated, but
Too many hurdles.
And this particularly affected a lot of Democratic leaning voters in minority communities and so on, students and so on. So there was less turnout. And I think these things, there's a combination of factors that have led to Republican dominance in Wisconsin. I think gerrymandering was one, and this flood of dark money, as well as a kind of weak Democratic message.
And so, Alec was behind all these voter ID laws that have swept.
Alec was involved with them. Yeah, it isn't just one thing.
Again.
Right, right. Alec is one part of a network that's very powerful, a conservative infrastructure that has been very effective at transforming many states. For example, Michigan, the home of the United Auto Workers, passed a right-to-work bill in 2013. Mm-hmm. And these right-to-work bills have been shown to correlate to a 3.5 decrease in Democratic turnout. So they're very effective.
Interesting. We are talking to Dan Kaufman about his book, The Fall of Wisconsin. And we are taking your calls, 800-642-1234. We've got some calls on the line, which we will get to in a moment. It's The Morning Show. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. Dan Kaufman, no relation, grew up in Wisconsin and is dismayed to have watched his beloved Wisconsin idea be put in the ash heap of history, perhaps. He wrote a book about it called The Fall of Wisconsin. What do you think about where the state is at? Are you comfortable with so much corporate influence and money in our elections? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Ideas at WPR.org, or you could tweet us at WPR Mornings. Brandon from Oshkosh, welcome to the program.
Yeah, hey there. So I can't agree more with the guest that you have on today. Everything that he's saying is right on par with what I've been thinking for quite some time. As a ex-prison worker, I was affected by Act 10, and I was wondering if he, in his book, was able to run any analytics on the numbers, you know, since Act 10, how many people have retired, and, you know, if it actually worked as far as saving the state any money, or did we end up spending more in overtime with all the openings in the prison system?
So you that's what you experienced in the prison system specifically, is that there were a lot of people left, and there was a lot of overtime pay?
Correct.
Okay. I don't know if you studied prison.
That's a great question, Brandon. Unfortunately, I didn't get to that in my book. I did do some, there's some research about teachers affected by Act 10. And one of the things, the University of Wisconsin's Education Department has experienced like a two-thirds drop in applications for people into their program. The teaching profession has really been damaged quite badly by Act 10, I would argue. And there's been some new research done, I think, by a professor at the University of Florida to show that there has been some decline in math and science scores in lower performing schools. What's happened is teachers have become a bit free agents, moving to wealthier school districts where they might get better deals, and it's left some of the lower performing schools really struggling to fill their teaching positions and so on. I don't know enough about the prison system, but that's a fascinating question, and I know a very important one, and you know, hopefully I can look into it in the future. So,
thank you very much, Brandon. I want to ask you about Alberta Darling. She was a Republican state senator that you used in as an example about how money has influenced the Wisconsin GOP.
I think so. The Wisconsin GOP was always had moderate strands, including, in fact, quite progressive ones. Bob La Follette was a Republican for most of his life.
But this was when the Republican Party was essentially what the Democratic Party is now, and the Democrats were essentially what the Republican
that's
is now.
That's true, but I would say that there were people that that tradition still existed for to a degree, you know, up until, you know, the last couple of decades. And Alberta Darling was a moderate Republican in many respects. She was at one time on the board of Planned Parenthood. More recently, she voted to defund Planned Parenthood. Mm. And her recall race was wound up costing, the total amount of dollars spent on this election was, I think, more than $10 million. This is for a state Senate job that pays $49,000 a year. So I think you see the influence. And with that came, with all of this money comes a more monolithic party. Dale Schultz, who voted against Act 10, as well as this mining bill, was basically shunned by the party. I mean, he told me as much. He was not given, he was cast out. He was not given any ability to bring up his bills and so forth. And he retired, not because he was going to lose, although there was a primary challenger to him. He had just grown fatigued with this relentless partisanship. Partisanship had always existed, but it was definitely taken to a new degree. And he felt, more importantly, that these laws were not coming from the citizens of the state. When he held a town hall meeting in his district about Act 10, he took notes. He stayed until everyone left. It was 500-2 against the bill. He felt he could not, in good conscience, he didn't support it, but he was basically reflecting the views of his constituents. They were not in favor of this.
So that's interesting to me. I mean, as people have seen partisanship, have seen their views not necessarily reflected in what the legislature is doing, they've gotten more angry. And as they've gotten more angry, they've turned to people who are anti-establishment candidates, which goes back to our conversation about Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump. Is this anger misdirected?
Well, I certainly think that a policy program that would help address their economic conditions would alleviate some of this anger. I think, you know, people look at Wisconsin's low unemployment rate and think that is signifying that everything is good. But, you know, when people look at what kinds of jobs are being created, there was a study done by the Economic Policy Institute that said suggested that much of the job growth is in low-wage industries with no benefits. So people
are
working.
There's tremendous poverty.
Yeah, there's tremendous struggling. And I think that that is fueling this anger. It's not the only cause. There's racism. There's misogyny. There's all kinds of things. And these things that are there are being stoked by leaders, and I think this economic insecurity amplifies them.
So. We are taking your calls for Dan Kaufman. He wrote the book, The Fall of Wisconsin. Greg from Stevens Point, welcome to the program.
Hi, yeah. I have a question about the mass exodus of high school graduates from the state of Wisconsin, specifically Dan actually being one of them. I've seen a lot of really well-trained upper-level high school graduates decide to move to bigger cities in other states. And I think when you have such a narrow electoral margin between Democrats and Republicans in a state like Wisconsin, to me, it's always been frustrating to watch people from Wisconsin who don't live here anymore say, what's happening to my state, without accounting for the fact that so many people have left and really allowed for these population demographics to change to skew more Republican and less Democrat.
You know, Greg, that's actually a really great question that I think we should probably do another hour on. What keeps people in a state, what makes people leave, and what does Wisconsin have and not have? That's an excellent question, but I will throw it to Dan.
Yeah, well, that's a good point, Greg. I left many decades ago for personal reasons, I think, like a lot of people. But very good point. I would say that if the state continued to move in a way that encouraged public investment. For example, the train
the
high speed rail that was going to connect Minneapolis to Chicago through Wisconsin had been promoted. I think that would have drawn a lot of people. I think public investment is attractive to people like the ones that you're talking about. The University of Wisconsin was an incredible magnet for decades for people from all over the country. Now faculty is being poached by the University of Minnesota and other universities. So I don't think it's just a decision made in a vacuum for a lot of people. My own situation was much earlier, not really related to that, personal reasons. And I think that's true for a lot of people. But I think if the state continued its tradition of public investment, I think it would keep a lot of people here. And in fact, Madison is doing the best. Dane County is doing very well compared to the rest of the state as far as having people moving in and so on. And I think that's a legacy of the idea of public investment.
Randy from Ripon, welcome to the program.
Hi, good morning. What I wanted to bring up, and I have to admit, I don't know what its current state is, but a couple of years ago, I read about Kansas and how Republicans were able to do everything they wanted to do, you know, cut taxes and all, and everything. I mean, it's a mess. I mean, people are leaving in droves, the economy's in the toilet.
Schools closed. A lot of schools have closed, yes.
And you know, I see what was happening in our state, and I just, and I'm a self-employed carpenter. But I also see the value of people making better money. And I've told my conservative peers that, you know, if everybody's only making $12 an hour, they're not going to own a house. They're not going to hire us. I mean, they can't afford to. Mm-hmm. And it's like we're going backwards. And you brought up, you know, I have friends that have kids that they want to get out of the state. I mean, they're in college. They have no desire to live here because, why? I look at our roads, our schools, our water treatment and drinking water, and we're on the edge in so many places that I...
Okay.
You know, you brought up Dade County, too. I mean, every liberal city, state, or country, economies are always faring better. But it never seems to be addressed either in the media. I don't know.
Thank you very much, Randy. We've done a few stories on this network about Wisconsin versus Minnesota. There's a little rivalry there, but Minnesota seems to be kicking our butts right now, and they have a lot of state investment.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I appreciate your comments and your call. I think that declining wages for some equals declining wages for everyone. I mean, this has been proven by studies that, you know, taking away union jobs, reducing wages.
It's not just the rising tide lifts all boats. It's also the tug, the undertow brings everybody down.
Yeah, it does. And I think that's a real problem. Minnesota is doing better. Governor Mark Dayton passed one of the largest tax hikes in history, I think, in 2012. And it was directed at the state's wealthiest residents. And a lot of that money was invested in things that I think benefited most of the state citizens. All day kindergarten. There was increased funding for the University of Minnesota. There was water treatment improvements and things like this that are of value to the whole of the citizenry. These kinds of common sense, pragmatic things were non-controversial in Wisconsin for a long time. Again, and you have the corporate-driven policy. You know, here's, for example, the frac sand mining in central Wisconsin. You know, the legislature has banned local communities from issuing any restrictions on it. Mm-hmm. This is a party that supposedly is for local control. The Republican Party is always identified with that, and yet, you know, it's proven impossible for people, and there's a lot of silica dust that people are inhaling and so on. I'm not sure if silica dust, so on. And studies have shown that this is damaging to people's health.
We are taking your calls in the last few minutes here. Mary from Lancaster, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you for taking my call. The reason I was calling is in regards to this, the dark money, the organizations like Alec and Will and that these organizations go back to, for a long time, Vice President Dick Cheney and his wife belonged to this group of organizations mm-hmm. that wanted to bring this country back to the Depression era, before the New Deal. These people are self-serving. They're not looking out for what's good for the country and all the people. They are looking out for themselves.
Okay, Mary.
Chosen people.
Thank you for that, Mary. I appreciate it. We're running out of time here. I'm going to go to Charlie in Milwaukee. Charlie, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. My first comment would be if you talk about the benefits of public investment and looking at Minnesota, one should also look south and look at Illinois and the mess that's there. problems with inappropriate state government, so to speak. But my real question is one of gerrymandering. Does your guest feel that the gerrymandering that has happened in Wisconsin, has that ruined any type of compromise or moderates in the state legislature, which is keeping Wisconsin behind? I truly believe that as a conservative, the gerrymandering that went on has left us a dearth of moderates, and that only hurts us.
Thank you, Charlie, very much. You've got about 30 seconds left to answer that question, Dan.
Yeah, I think gerrymandering hurts everyone. Yeah, I mean, I think the caller is right. So,
And we can probably deal with Illinois with a week's worth of programs. It is a mess down there. Thank you, Dan Kaufman, for being with us today.
Thank you, Carrie. It was a real pleasure. Thanks a lot.
Dan Kaufman's book is called The Fall of Wisconsin. The Morning Show is produced by Colleen Leahy, Brianne Shasso, Chris Molina, Laura Pavin, and Sarah Hopeful. Michael Derringer is our technical director. Keely Boltina is the executive producer. I'm Carrie Kaufman, and this is the Ideas Network.